Hi there.
Hello, I'm Justin Souther. You're Ken Hankey.
Yep, I am Ken Hankey.
Mountain Express film critics.
That's true.
We've been to the movies.
We have indeed, and then, which makes us, of course, elitist bastards. Yes. And here we are.
Outside the Carolina.
Outside the Carolina.
Someone was watching television upstairs.
Yes,
and we didn't want to run them
off. So they have thrown us into the street like a dead rat. But we are here in lovely, picturesque
Skyland.
Yes.
Still Asheville, I guess.
On Hendersonville Road. Mm-hmm. The, as I've stated before, lush, picturesque garden spot of Asheville. Are we ready?
Yeah.
All right.
Let's do this.
Yeah, let's get you out of the way first, because you only saw one movie.
Which is the Tillman story, the documentary about Pat Tillman.
That's true.
The former football player who gave up millions of dollars to join the Army Rangers in Afghanistan after 9/11. He was killed, and then his death was used as a bit of propaganda by the government, pro-war propaganda. So most of the film is talking about Tillman and his family's efforts to get the truth out of the government, which are pretty more or less for naught. I mean, by the end of the movie, we learn that nobody's really held responsible for, lying.
I'm not really surprised that the government, you know, isn't going to tell you that your son was killed by friendly fire. That right. doesn't really shock me too
well,
much.
Well, the thing is, they come out later and say, yeah, it was friendly fire, but they won't give the details of what happened exactly.
Okay, well,
who knew about it, who lied about it, so.
But the idea that you take this guy and turn him into something that he wasn't.
Right. Because the portrait the film paints of Tillman is that he was a pretty intelligent guy. He was
kind of intellectual jock and also, as I understand, an atheist.
Yes. And not so extremely. He wanted to defend his country, but he thought Iraq was unjust. He didn't agree with that war. But it's more about how the government had just tried to simplify him into a hero.
Well, heroes, by their very definition, need to be simple so people can understand them.
Right. But it's a good documentary. I don't think it necessarily says anything new. It might say it in a bit of a different way. But I think it's, I mean, personally for me, it's mostly because I'm pretty jaded when it comes to our government at this point. Surprising. It's unfortunate that we don't find this surprising,
I think that is probably more unfortunate than the fact that the government is corrupt in this manner is
right.
The fact that we don't expect any better.
And that's not, I don't think that's what the film intends you to take from it, but that's what I got.
No, but I think that is an inherent problem with almost all activist documentary filmmakers, is they think they are uncovering something new and shocking because they're so narrowly focused on this one thing that they don't realize that they're part of this greater picture
right.
of a whole buttload of films like this.
Right.
In any case, it, you know, did the film, the film died. It's
right.
going to be gone by Friday.
You watched Due Date, right?
Yes, I watched Due Date. I went into Due Date with some measure of hope. It didn't take long to dash those hopes. I like Robert Downey Jr., and I was impressed with Mr. Galifianakis in that movie that I always screw the title up on.
Kind of a funny story.
It's kind of a funny story, yeah.
But you were not impressed with him.
No, I have now. I have to admit, I did not see The Hangover, so I don't really know if it was this laugh-a-minute, raucous, hysterical role in the aisle comedy.
I didn't think it was
portrayed as, but I have seen other films from Todd Phillips, like mm-hmm. School for Scoundrels and
Old School. Did he make
Old School, which was my first exposure to Will Ferrell. I have to thank him for that. And I have been invariably underwhelmed to different degrees by his films. He made something else, which I can't remember what it is right now, probably because it didn't offend me as much as the other two. This is a one-note comedy. This is Robert Downey Jr. needs to get home, and he's uptight for reasons that we are never given, except for the fact that he's uptight so that he can play off Mr. Galifianakis. Whatever.
It's not that difficult.
Yes, it is. How do you not pronounce that A?
You just don't. You just say, "Hey Ken, don't pronounce his A." Just.
So does that make
just
him
run over it, Ken?
Zach Galifianakis.
No.
Oh, okay.
Only one of the A's.
I see. In any case,
we'll get you there, bud.
No. By the time I get it right, he will no longer be a star. Since he pretty much is, I think, flavor of the month.
I don't know.
We'll see. In any case, he has to get home because his wife is going to have a baby. That is the due date of the title. Well, from contrivances so contrived that they're unbelievable, he and Mr. G get thrown off the airplane as suspected terrorists and thrown onto a no-fly list. Somehow in all this, he has lost his wallet with all of his money and his identification and his credit cards. So he is completely screwed. And guess what? That means he's going to have to accept a ride from Mr. G, who is possibly the stupidest human being in the history of cinema. Hilarity ensues.
Right.
No, annoyance ensues. That's pretty much what ensues. That and lame, flat jokes. And we get a cameo appearance by the ever unfunny Danny McBride. I realize the North Carolina film school mafia will be all over me for saying that. That is actually even less funny than the usual appearance by Danny McBride. I mean, Danny McBride to me is a guy whose greatest performance was as the cardboard cutout in Up in the Air. I thought he was very subtle in that role. Unfortunately, then he appeared later in the film and ruined that, but, you know, what the hell. In any case, due date is unworthy of both its stars and its audience. And that's all we'll say about that. Ah, yes, Megamind in generally wasted 3D. For the most part, this movie didn't need to be in 3D, and if you can catch it in 2D and save yourself the $3 to $5 extra charge, you would be wise.
I think it did... Here at least did better in 2D. It sold
really?
More tickets. From what I mean.
Well, yeah. I know that when. Now, granted, it was a weekday, so children were in school, but when Brian and I went to it on Friday morning, we were the audience. Which, of course, has the advantage you can make comments, but it becomes completely adequate. And never becomes anything more than adequate. It's okay. It's never hysterically funny. It's never incredibly clever. It's harmless and adequate. I'm not sure that there really is a whole lot more to say about it other than the fact that it is indeed adequate.
That sounds good enough. Apparently, I'm asking you what you thought of Four Colored Girls.
Yeah, well...
Is it better than Three Colored Girls?
Are four Marx Brothers better than three?
Depends.
Yeah.
What about five Marx Brothers?
Well, Gummo never made a movie, so I don't know. In any case, it's, you know, obviously...
Would this movie be better with the Marx Brothers?
any movie would be better with the Marx Brothers, except they have this big disadvantage like being dead. That, however, would still make them funnier than most of today's comics. But let's see here. Here's a surprising thing. Four Colored Girls, which I've joked is the Tyler Perry new title of Four Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough for the Twitter generation. In point of fact, I think it's honestly half title and half dedication. It is both awful and wonderful, depending on where you look in this film. There are moments in it that are absolutely sublime. Give the man credit. He has actually done something worth looking at. However, it's also infused with more Tyler Perry soap opera melodrama to hold these poems together than you can shake a stick at. And I wouldn't mind, although I do think the part where we threw the two children out the window from the fifth floor and the attempted exorcism was a little much.
Sounds like the best part of the movie.
It may well have been in some respects, but in any case, these things should just kind of leave you going, wow. But the problem is that Perry doesn't understand. It's like these films could be made by Pedro Almodovar if Almodovar had no sense of humor. Is that Perry does not understand these things are absurd. He just takes them all very seriously, which only makes them that much funnier. Which is unfortunate, because there's really, somewhere inside this thing, is a really good film with some really good performances. Unfortunately, one of the biggest performances in it comes from Janet Jackson, who isn't, frankly, all that good. And she's definitely out of her depth up against the other actresses. But it's as close as you're ever going to find so far to me recommending a Tyler Perry picture. And I don't know what his core audience will make of it, because it's got no weed or fart jokes in it. It's got the God is dragged into it virtually not at all, except for the Whoopi Goldberg religious fanatic character, and she's not what you would call admirable. Which, so the whole Tyler Perry peddles the gospel thing has somehow gone out the window with this. So it's an interesting picture in any number of respects. I wish it was better. But if he'll make something else that isn't adapted from one of his Chitlin Circuit plays, I might actually be anxious to see it, as opposed to, oh, God.
So you light your cigarette, and we're not promoting smoking. Mostly.
We're not promoting smoking. I shouldn't be, but, well, I am. In any case, what are you going to ask me about now?
Well, what I'm assuming
our producer, who is no longer speaking to me, won't tell me what you're going to ask me about.
I'm assuming the thing you were looking most forward to.
He was all loquacious last week. Now he's not going to even talk to me.
Don't feel like it usually, but...
Yeah, well, I understand that.
Anyway...
Yes?
Nowhere
he
Boy.
He said tersely.
I'm assuming... You just talk about the movie. I don't feel like... We're wasting time, Ken.
Yeah, we are. Well, like we weren't. Nowhere Boy. From a personal standpoint, it was the thing that I liked best this weekend. But I'm interested in the subject matter. I'm really fond of the Beatles and of John Lennon.
Really?
Really. So I was interested on going in. And then when it opens with a chord from Hard Day's Night and a dream sequence, which is young 15-year-old John Lennon running, much as he does in the beginning of Hard Day's Night, I was kind of sold. And then it just got more and more. It felt very authentic to me. And it felt very authentic to me. It felt like it really was 1955. The Beatles are never mentioned, so if you think you're going to go see a Beatle movie, you're, you know, wrong. Paul and George do show up during the course of the film, but it gets to a point at the very end where the name of the group could be mentioned, and the dialogue actually skirts around it in such a way that it never is. I honestly believe, however, that it is a film that the more you know when you go in, probably the more you'll actually enjoy it, because it will increase not only your knowledge of, you know, it's like, okay, you already kind of know what the situation with John and his aunt and John and his mother are. And also, there will be key elements, one particular key element that most of us know, although we may not know how it happened, that you're kind of, they have sort of a suspense value, because you know it's got to happen and you're just kind of waiting to see how it's handled and where it happens. And knowing that it was going to happen and being pretty sure where it was going to happen, it still manages to be somewhat shocking. And I really found the film to be a very, very pleasant experience. I don't know why it was booked at the Bowcatcher. I'm amazed that it has been given a second week, because it did like $450 the entire weekend. There were four other people in the audience when I saw it. So, you know, the Bowcatcher doesn't get art/indie films very often. So it'd be really nice if folks would get out there and actually support one when they do get it. And this one, I think, is worthy of support. Assuming you're interested in the subject matter, you don't give a shit about the Beatles or John Lennon, this movie isn't for you. And, of course, if you do, you may want to pick it apart, because it's not what you think it should be. So, I think it's for you. If you don't think it's for you, well, then you're wrong.
We've just talked about stuff that
That played this past weekend. Now we're talking about, yeah, two movies that I've seen that are opening this week, and one of them is Four Lions.
Which has been somewhat controversial, since it's
got really good reviews for the most part. But bear in mind, this is a movie that follows actually five Brit would-be jihadists who are hell-bent to blow up something. They don't really care what. They want to blow up something and themselves and get to heaven and their 72 virgins or whatever it is. And it gets comedy out of this. Mm-hmm. They're also spectacularly stupid and spectacularly inept. These boys are, if there were four of them, I would say they would be the Groucho, Harpo, Chico, and Zeppo of terrorism. But they're not that smart. One of them wants to train crows as suicide bombers. This actually just results in an untimely demise of a crow and a lot of feathers. And I don't know. He seems to think the crow will go to heaven and get 72 crow virgins, but I think that's sort of probably unlikely. The whole thing is very interesting, though, in that you actually do kind of come to like these guys. And I think that's what makes the film disturbing as well as funny. And don't kid yourself, this film's going to go all the way. It's going to go to the grimmest basic conclusion. And trust me, the counter-jihadists are no smarter in this film than the guys they're after. They have surveillance on the wrong people. They shoot the wrong person at one point because one of them can't tell the difference between somebody in a bear costume and somebody in a Wookiee costume, which ends up with endless bickering back and forth between two snipers. So, you know, I mean, it's a very, very dark humored film. But assuming you can deal with the accents, because the accents are thick. You know, we've got working class Brit and working class Brit with accent on top of that in some cases. But it's very disturbingly funny. And probably the thing that's opening this week that strikes me as the most bang for your buck as far as quality, unusual, and extremely... There are so many films and things that call themselves edgy. This actually is.
Jesus.
I thought maybe you had forgotten.
No.
Okay.
Inside job, Kim, what did you think about it? How was it? Was it wonderful?
Wonderful is not the word you use for Inside Job, because it's one of those, it's another documentary.
Is this a different kind of Inside Job than what Steve was going to give you earlier?
Well, back when Steve was talking to me, yes. That,
okay.
Since he's no longer talking to me, I don't know what kind of job he's going to give me. In any case.
That's getting cut.
Well, that's unfortunate. Yeah. In any case,
this
is it's not the kind of movie. It really is not the kind of movie that you enjoy. It's a documentary, and it's a documentary that pretty much breaks down just exactly how the economic collapse happened, how corrupt the system is and has been for 20-odd years, and how the corruption is propagated by whoever's in office from Clinton made worse. It starts with Reagan. Of course, that's carried on by Bush the First. Clinton basically does the same policies. W makes them even worse than Clinton did. And now Obama has put the exact same people back in charge of the candy store. So nothing has really changed. And it's infuriating and somewhat depressing, but it probably is one of those, yeah, you should see this one, if only because it will infuriate and depress you, and in an area that you probably should be infuriated and depressed.
And that's Thursday's horror picture show.
F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu.
Right. Was almost lost, correct?
Yeah, it was almost lost. Well, it was almost lost because Bram Stoker's widow sued Murnau for making an unauthorized version of Dracula, uh-huh. which he seemed to think that if he just changed the names, it wouldn't be, it very obviously is a version of Dracula. And he lost the lawsuit, and all the prints were ordered to be destroyed. But thanks to film pirates...
on the high seas.
Yes, film pirates on the high seas for collectors on the high seas. Enough copies remained that we still have the film. And now it's been pretty much restored. It looks pretty good, especially for a 1922 film. It still strikes me as the absolute creepiest vampire picture ever made. And is the only film, only horror film, maybe the only film, that has ever given me a nightmare. And I remember that nightmare fairly clearly, or at least aspects of it. And while it probably is possible, if you're not familiar with silent movies, especially as early as 1922, that it is probably possible to oversell the film to an audience who doesn't know what they're getting into. But I don't think you can oversell Max Schreck's Orlok, which has got to be the most pestilential-looking vampire ever. And no attempt to actually duplicate that makeup has really done it. Though Willem Dafoe comes close. And that, of course, segues us into...
Shadow of the Vampire.
Right, which we're showing...
Tuesday. Right. For the Film Society.
Right. And that was due to clever programming, so that you can see Nosferatu on Thursday, and then the following Tuesday you can come to the actual Film Society screening, also at 8 o'clock, and also in the Cinema Lounge, and also at the Carolina on Hendersonville Road, the lush, picturesque garden spot of Asheville. And then you can see a movie about how it was made, taken to extremes. And the movie is historically significant for me because I am reasonably certain it is the first new release during my reviewing tenure at the Mountain Express that I gave 5 stars.
I think if you could pull up your review of it, you state that this is the first movie you've given 5 stars.
Well, it might be. I think I'd given Hard Day's Night 5 stars before that, but that hardly counts because it wasn't exactly a new movie in 2000. So, in any case, It's a surprisingly funny film. It's grounded in the idea, which was a legend for a long time, that Max Schreck did not exist. Or that there may have been a Max Schreck, which there obviously was because he has his movie credits, but that that is not him in Nosferatu, but that instead it is some unknown actor. Well, the film takes the idea to the extremes and says it's not an unknown actor, it's an Honest to Stoker vampire. And it goes from there. The only problem with it, you could buy the film up to the point that people who have film credits long after this film start getting killed. And then it just becomes a little bit over the top. But it's really still truly a remarkable film. And in some ways, it probably does reflect a lot of the way that things were when Nosferatu was originally made. And it does duplicate some of the atmosphere. And Willem Dafoe makes a terrific Max Schreck. John Malkovich makes a very good Murnau, too. Even Cary Elwes is not awful. Hey, for Cary Elwes, that's big praise.
What do we have this weekend?
Other than Four Lions and Inside Job, we have
Skyline, which looks god-awful.
You don't want to see a movie?
I kind of do want to see
it, 'cause it looks about aliens hoovering up mankind.
Well, I like the fact that they don't even promote who is in this movie.
Well, there's nobody in it you ever heard of.
Yeah, it's just vacuuming up people.
Well, I mean, you know, this is a movie that is coming to us from the guys who made Alien versus Predator Requiem.
Okay.
Need I say more? People who bill themselves as the Brothers Strauss. But, I mean, it's a film about vacuum cleaners from outer space hoovering up humanity, which has got to be, A, it's dumb, and B, the
footage.
It's quite
a metaphor, though, when you think
about it. Yes, it is. But the biggest thing is that the shots in distant views look like bad outtakes from Life Force. But when you see it closer up and can actually see little teeny tiny people being sucked up into these spaceships as they're hoovered in by the aliens, it's hysterical.
I was sitting next to you, and we both saw that.
I mean, I really am hoping the whole film is this cosmically dumb.
Well, it is the Strudel Brothers.
This is true.
I guess it's technically an art release conviction.
It's a quasi art release. It's a conviction. Is a very earnest looking, fact based story, which I find, if what I have learned is indeed true, is kind of funny in that the essence of the film is true, but it misses a central irony of reality. It's all about how this working class woman, played by Hilary Swank and her gigantic teeth, put herself through law school so she could get her wrongly convicted brother, played by Sam Rockwell, who, by the way, is getting much better reviews than she is for this film, who's been wrongly convicted of murder, to get him out of jail. And it's giving away no surprises, since it has a rousing feel-good ending, that she does. What the film does not tell you is that shortly thereafter he fell off a wall and died. Which I think would have been a suitably ironic. They also don't point out that, unlike Sam Rockwell, her brother was apparently morbidly obese. So he's been cast with a greater box office. I haven't seen a picture, so I'm only...
Are you saying people would laugh at a morbidly obese man falling off a wall to end this movie?
No, I think that they have tried to goose the box office by putting Sam Rockwell in the role. And like I said, Rockwell is getting better reviews than she is.
Dom DeLuise.
Juliet, Dom DeLuise would be excellent. But I don't think he's morbidly obese. I mean,
is he even alive?
I don't remember. Ask him. Okay. You know, I'm sure the film is well intended. Tony Goldwyn, who directed it, is a mediocre actor who has thus far made mediocre films. So that bothers me far more than anything else about the film. The supporting cast is good. I like Sam Rockwell. I usually don't like Hilary Swank very much, but I'm willing to give her the benefit of the doubt. She's been okay in some things. She was even okay in Amelia, although my absolute favorite was the poster for her horror film, The Reaping, with its big headline, "What hath God wrought?" And the next word is Hilary Swank.
And then we have another Tony Scott train. He's in his train phase, I guess.
When was his last train?
Pelham 123.
Oh. Yeah, well, this one
seems much dumber somehow.
Has the manipulated color palette,
yes,
that we expect from Mr. Scott.
And if this movie does not have that Soul Asylum song for the entire soundtrack, I'm going to be sorely disappointed.
What is the song?
Runaway Train.
Oh, is there a song called Runaway
Train? Never Coming Back. Ken's too old. Steve knows what I'm talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I can't tell because I can't see Steve nod his head because he's not talking to me.
Well, it was famous in the early 90s because it had the music video was just missing kids. It was photos of missing kids.
I see. Well,
so hopefully, you know, if it doesn't happen, you know,
it's going to do well. It's PG-13. It's got Denzel in it, and it's got Chris Pine for the other demographic in it. You know, that covers an old to mid-range audience. It covers a young audience. Kids can get into it, and it promises nonstop, over-the-top, stupid-looking action.
It looks really dumb. It might look too dumb, is what I'm thinking. But
I guess we'll find out.
Because it's
or one of us
it's
will.
A train, runaway train. It's never coming back, Ken.
I see.
Never.
No, it's going to blow up. And I think that's what's hysterical about it is it's not merely a runaway train. It's a runaway train that's going to explode.
And I guess opening tomorrow actually is.
Yes, and I
Morning
don't know
Glory.
Morning Glory. A
sounds
a,
vaguely sexual to me.
I think of a vine with flowers on it. So, you know,
it's the whole thing. It just sounds. I don't know.
Well, you know, he's. Congratulations, you're more perverted than I am, and that is astonishing to realize. It's a romantic comedy. It stars Rachel McAdams as a TV producer who is in between cohering and refereeing embattled morning anchors.
Harrison Ford.
And Diane Keaton. And the early reviews were brutal, but the longer reviews keep piling up, the better the reviews have gotten. So.
And it looks like a role that, for Harrison Ford, that, at least from the trailer.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's just, you know, it looks like it's probably fine for what it is, and maybe it's even a little bit better than fine. I no longer dread it. Put it that way, and at one point I was starting to dread it. So now I'm merely curious.
Well, good.
Good.
I guess we're done, right?
Yeah, I think we've probably had enough. I have.
Well, I'm Justin Souther. You're Ken Hinkey.
Uh-huh. Okay. I don't recognize you anymore since you were missing for a week, you know. So. Yeah, and I'm Ken Hinkey, I think. And we're the film critics for the Mount Express, mm-hmm. who are the people kind and dumb enough to let us do this. And as usual, our program was produced by Steve Shanafelt, who is no longer speaking to me since I had good things to say about a Tyler Perry movie. And we will see whether or not he will even tell me when we are recording next week, or perhaps he will just resign in disgust. Can't blame him.